The Variety Artist, episode 20. This one's all about traveling the world on a ping pong ball. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast on your phone or mobile device. It really helps me a lot. Before we start the show, a couple of things. First, you'll notice that I rated this interview an E for explicit. The entire interview is rated PG, but one word. I thought about editing it out, but the story was so good and that one word was so important that I couldn't. It's Michael's horror story. You'll see what I mean. You've been warned. Secondly, throughout the interview, we reference a bunch of Michael's videos. I suggest you go and take a look at his performances on his YouTube channel. Just search Michael Troutman on YouTube. It'll give you a much better understanding of what we're talking about. All right, enough me. Let's get it going. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. They're offering you, the Variety Artist, a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at thevarietyartist.com/book. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Just go to thevarietyartist.com/book right after this podcast and get your free audiobook. Now, let's start the show.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
He's been described as a visual comic, performance artist, a new vaudevillian, mime, physical comedian, storyteller, magician, and fool. He claims only to be a clown, but he's also known around the world as King Pong. He was the star clown with the Big Apple Circus, been on ABC, TNN, and performed at theaters and festivals around the world. He has way too many credits to list here. Variety Artist, I give you Michael Troutman.
Thank you. Hi, John.
How you doing, Michael?
I'm well.
Good. So for people who don't know you here yet, what exactly is it that you do?
I am a variety artist. That's been the latest tag I've been using. I started out as a mime in the 70s when mime was extremely popular. Went through all of the other disciplines. I studied almost every kind of movement that I could find, and I have performed as a clown, magician, juggler, storyteller, actor. You name it, I've probably done it. I've worked in all markets that you can think of, from the street to the stage.
One of the things I was reading is something about, you said something on your website about steps of the creative process. Do you have specific steps of the creative process? I'm always fascinated with those philosophies.
Do you want me to list the steps in it?
Can you give us a couple? Can you give us a little taste of a couple of steps that you go through when you're putting together a new routine?
Yeah, sure. One of the things that I start with is actually an improvisational exercise that I learned from Tony Montanaro, and it's called rounds. The idea behind rounds is you take an idea or an object, for example, a ping pong ball.
Yes.
And you get in the studio with that ping pong ball and you begin to play. And you don't give yourself any rules or expectations. You just play in the way that a child will play, in the way that animals will play. You hold it, you do whatever you can with it. You look at it and try and envision multiple uses or ideas, and if you apply that same idea to a theme, you go with your notebook or your friends and you say, okay, let's just come up with ideas. What's it mean? What's it do? And explore and try and list as many of the possibilities in the idea or the object that you can find. Once you've got this list of ideas, you look at it and go, well, this one relates to that one, or this one's interesting to me. And so you pick an idea that's interesting and try and follow that path. It's a matter of giving yourself an idea, a thought, and try always coming back to that path. So if I'm using the ping pong ball, I played with it in the studio, and the target spinning act that I do is a good example. I got in the studio and I was trying to do create a new bounce act with it, bouncing the ping pong ball off of something back into my mouth. It was very difficult because I wanted to bounce off of four or five different surfaces so that it would go bing, 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 and back to my mouth. So it was, mm-hmm. had to be very precise, though, with the ping pong ball. I had marble tiles, and they were all propped up at different angles. And it was because it was so variable in, you know, where the ball hit and if it was how wet it was coming out of my mouth. And so that sort of accuracy wasn't possible. But I did notice that I was able to hit consistently the same spot on the tile that I was shooting at. And then, so then I made that leap somehow into, well, if I can be accurate with it and I don't worry about catching it, I'm a target spitter. And okay. So then I began to research target shooting acts, and there's plenty of information out there. And so I followed that thread and in the end came up with this character who came out of that. So it's a matter of sticking with that original thought, what can I do with that ping pong ball? Long enough to find an idea that's has some value to me as a performer, then some perceived value and entertainment value to the audience. And how do you find that? And everybody's going to be different. Two people that start with the same premise don't end up in the same place at all.
Yeah, because they have different ideas on how to use the
right.
prop
exactly.
or whatever it is.
Exactly. So that's a piece of it. It's really being in the studio, trying to play in order to come up with possibilities and then being able to work through those possibilities and find what it is. And that takes a period of germination. You know, you play with all these ideas and you go off, and the next day you come back and you play with more ideas and you go take a break and you come back and you let it sit and simmer and gestate. And eventually the better ideas bubble up to the top and you begin to be able to create more and make something out of that.
Now, what you were describing with the ping pong ball, that's how you came up with the King Pong's Ping Pong Rodeo, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Also online, by the way, if you want to see a great act, take a look at King Pong's Ping Pong Rodeo. It's hilarious. It's really funny and it's fun. I don't know how many targets that you hit, how many routines that you have. I noticed there's two completely separate routines. There's the ping pong rodeo, but then there's also kind of a magic act you do with the ping pong balls in the mouth.
Right. I have actually, in the last 7 years, I've developed an entire show that's all ping pong ball related routines. And it's an hour and 15 minutes without an intermission. It's a fun routine. There's another older clip of that routine that I did up at Celebration Bar, and it's not a great recording, but the audience is really fantastic in it. And for my money, that here's a piece of advice for all you variety entertainers. The audience reaction is of utmost importance in the video. You can get away with a lower quality video picture than you can. I find it, the videos that work best are those that have a really lively audience that's having a great time.
I agree with you. Yeah, if you get a chance, anybody listening to this, you can go on my Facebook group and listen to that or watch that.
And listen to it. Yes, both.
Both, listen and watch.
You can sit on the toilet and enjoy it.
If you want. Now, I noticed in a lot of your videos, one of the great things about your performances is that when you come out as a clown or whatever character you have, you let your act breathe. So many people come out and they say, oh, I'm doing this and I'm doing that. And they yeah. run around like crazy people, but you let your act breathe. Tell me about that.
I'm a clown. My most important thing that I do is to let the audience see me, to be vulnerable as a character, as this clown on stage, so that they can trust me and like me and follow me wherever absurd place I'm going. And so if I come out and cover it up by doing something, which is almost everyone's impulse, then but rather I can come out and just let them see me and be happy that they see me, and then they're on my side. I take a breath there. That's a very good description of it. But I'm just trying to be present. Too often artists come on and you can be doing something already, but you still have to let the audience see you at first. If you come on and they never see who this person is, they're not quite as connected, I think. You know, it's an interesting thing. And I tell this to students that there's only one universal language, and that's body language, and it's in every culture all around the world. You can communicate non-verbally, no matter where you are, no matter what the language barriers are, the spoken language barriers, because you can gesture and understand each other on a fundamental level. That makes everyone in the world expert body language readers. And so audiences are experts. They sit there and they read your body language when you're on stage. All you have to do is make sure that you're saying the right things all the time with your body language. But as soon as you're uncomfortable or nervous or feel like you're screwing up, then you know what the audience sees? They see some guy who's uncomfortable and nervous and screwing up. And right. They want you to succeed. That was one of Tony's great messages to me, was that the audience wants you to be great every time. They don't really want you to come out and fail. They want you to entertain them and have fun. And so if you're having fun and entertaining them, then you're succeeding because they read that and they're having fun with you.
Yeah, they paid good money and they want to see somebody do something really cool.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to ask you about they're not really, I can't call them silent acts because they're not really silent, but a lot of your acts are without words. And that makes it easy to travel around the world and do cruise ships and that.
Right.
Is that kind of by design?
Again, it goes back to my roots as a mime artist and my interest in physical theater and physical gesture and communication. I find that as soon as I start speaking, I stop moving as much. And I think it's pretty true for most people. We forget about our bodies because the voice can be so dominant. And, mm-hmm. and so expressive, and you hear the words and you process anyway. So I'm always drawn to the more physical, and I think I'm a pretty good mover and communicate good physically.
Pretty good as being
it's a bit, you know, it's a bit of a curse sometimes because I more than once I've been out, you know, just watching people, or I'd look at somebody and they look at me you know, with this sort of horrified expression, and I realized what's probably happened is that I wasn't in control of my face and I was thinking something horrible or offensive, and I'm pretty easy to read. And so I'm sure I've offended people from time to time by the way I'm just looking at them.
Well, let's talk about your street performing. Years back, I imagine you did some street performing, right?
Yeah, all the way back to week before last.
Way back then.
I like outdoor festival performing. And I've always done, even when I wasn't doing a lot of street performing, I was still doing fairs, county fairs, state fairs, and where you've got to draw your audience and get them to come over and stick around because they might have to go see the pig races or something. The only difference is I don't have you in the fairs. You're not hitting them up for money or at the festival. And you probably have a better sound system than you do on the street.
Right. Well, when you're on the street, are there some certain secrets to street performing, putting out that hat and getting that money in there?
I think street performing and making money is one of the harder forms of entertainment, of performance. You're working in an adverse climate outside. The weather can end the show or make it fantastic or make it just unbearable to do. Crazy people and everything, anything can and will go wrong. And you've got to draw people's attention and keep their attention and be able to do material that has a good length to it so that people who are just coming up don't feel like they've missed a whole lot or they don't know what's going on. And then the hat pitch is an important thing. And I find that the one thing that works best, besides having a grand finale trick where you're on a 25-foot pole with your hair on fire and juggling chainsaws. If you can do that, then it's not as important about the hat pitch. But if you're a guy like me that needs some support, I find that honesty is what brings the money in. Dropping your character and speaking to them person to person and being honest about why you do this, what you're doing, what you hope for them. And you don't have to say, give me your money, but, you know, make people aware that this is how you're making your living. And it's a valuable thing to be able to, my lit pitch has been lately based on the idea of community. I talk to the audience. I say, I'm glad you're here. I'm here in your community, and this is part of your community, and we're all here together, and this is what makes the community stronger, is coming out and having common experience like this, being entertained, having fun, and laughing. You're here with your families. What a terrific opportunity to just be around the people. It's free. You don't have to have any money to come and watch this show. It's a straight-ahead appeal to their humanity and my humanity, which needs some support. So, you know, lay it on me.
Yeah. No, I like that pitch because I'm in Southern California and we have Venice Beach, which you've probably performed.
I never performed there, but I'm well aware of it.
Okay. Well, when you go down to Venice Beach, everybody who does the hat pitch, it's a big giant pitch, put your money in here. And by the time you hear two or three of them, you're so tired of hearing them.
Right.
By the time someone starts their hat pitch, sometimes you walk away.
Right.
So an honest approach would be refreshing.
Yeah. Wouldn't it? Huh?
Yeah.
In life as well.
In life as well. Now tell me about, you were a star clown for the Big Apple Circus. Tell me the difference kind of between kind of a circus performance or a festival type of performance.
First off, the show I did with Big Apple Circus was a stage show. It was the only stage show that they ever did in the 1999-2000 season. The idea was supposed to come from Midnight Circus. Do you know who those people are?
No.
The Big Apple was trying to do a similar thing, and their first attempt at it didn't work. But they came up with the Shakespearean scenes and circus. And so we had some actors and we had circus performers. And it was a lot of fun. But we played large performing arts centers. So it was, 1,000, 2,000 seats, 48 people in a cast and crew, bus and truck type tour.
Yeah.
And we did a national tour. And the reason that they hired me was because they perceived me as a stage clown. There's a belief that there's a big difference between the circus clown and the stage clown. There's a big difference between working in the ring and working on the stage, because the audience is all around you. I've seen all sorts of performers and clowns successfully work in the ring, but you do have to be aware of where your audience is. And so in that sense, it's more akin to street performing, working in the circus ring, than it is to the stage. The fourth wall is completely gone in the circus ring. I mean, it is. It's always gone. You can make a serious act, but you always want that connection with the audience, no matter what you're doing in the ring.
Sure, because it's always in the round, so you always have to be conscious of that.
Right, and so it's just a different shape. The idea of the fourth wall not being there is, I think, one of the primary parts and differences between the circus and the stage, even. And even the circus in the theater has the opportunity to make use of the fourth wall better than the ring does.
Now, I saw on Facebook you had some sort of a injury on your face.
I put that up and people have been alarmed by it, and I didn't mean to alarm anyone.
Well, tell us about the ping pong bullet catch.
I've created, you know what a potato cannon is?
Yes.
PVC and air pressure, cheaper homemade versions often have some sort of explosive, but you can make an air pressure version that is clean and safe, or relatively safe.
Yeah.
And I've created, as part of my King Pong's Ping Pong Rodeo, one of the acts in that is King Pong's ping pong bullet catch of near death. Do you know what a bullet catch trick is?
I do know what a bullet catch trick is.
To your audience, yeah, your audience probably does. You know, the magician's trick where they have a real rifle and get the local sheriff to autograph a bullet and put it in and shoot it, and the magician, it would go through a piece of glass and the magician would catch the bullet in his teeth.
Right.
And so I've developed a ping pong cannon that's like a potato gun made with PVC, and I've got a bike pump that I can get up to about 150 PSI if I really want to hurt myself.
So you really pump it. I've seen the video. You're really pumping the pressure in there.
I try and get it up over 100 PSI just because you want that, that much movement and power in it. The bruises happen from time to time. if I'm too close, sometimes you're in a place that you can't be that far away, or the, you know, pressure gets, it's all varied. Really, it only will bruise if it hits sort of directly, hits a bone. It's, for me, it's part of the reason for doing it, that people look at it and go, well, that's stupid.
Well, let me describe this.
People
listening can kind of know what you're talking about. You have, of course, the potato gun looking thing, and you have an audience member put in, I don't know how many ping pong balls. What is that? 5, 6, 7?
I shoot one ball off, and usually I can shoot it about 100 yards if I'm out in the open. And then I have an audience member sign a ping pong ball and put that one in the gun, and then they put another 10 or 11 balls on top of that.
Okay.
And then we pump the gun up, and I stand in front of it, and they pull the trigger, and I catch their signed ping pong ball in my mouth.
Gotcha. And then at the very end, you reveal the ping pong ball.
Yeah. Yes. And try to have them take it, but they never want to touch it.
can't imagine why. So then you reveal the ping pong ball, put it in a red cup or something, right?
Yes, and they will take it for a souvenir occasionally, not often though.
This one a couple of days ago, gotcha, huh?
Yeah, you know what? Those are from all different times. I collect photos of the bruises for some sick reason. and I thought, well, I'll put a bunch of them up just because I had some time, and it was, you know, Instagram. So, I don't know. But part of the point is it's a stupid thing to point a gun at yourself and shoot you, because even a ping pong ball will leave a pretty good mark.
It's a great act.
Yeah, I think so. I'm excited about it. I'm finally getting some video of it. It's fairly new, and I'm waiting to get some more video. I was doing it on the street up in Edmonton, and getting a great reaction there. So
you're just continuing the ping pong journey.
I'd been doing the magic act since almost the beginning, the piece I do on Le Plus Grand Cabaret. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I started learning how to do the juggling thing. And I do a bit of that. Most of mine's comedy juggling. I'm not really a good ping pong ball spinning juggler. But then I started coming up with other routines and ideas, and that's expanded and grown and grown. And so I've treated the ping pong ball as what a painters call it, their media.
Yeah.
So my media is the ping pong ball. I just have to figure out, you know, what are the things that I can do with it. And there's still plenty more. You would, believe it or not, though I have an hour and 15 minutes worth of performance material with ping pong balls, I've got another, who knows, 45 minutes, an hour of ideas that aren't performance.
I'm sure it's unlimited. It's a great idea, because instead of people saying, gee, I want to hire a magician, or want to hire whatever they decide they want to hire, if they want the ping pong ball guy, it's you.
That's me. Yeah, I just did a performance out in Las Vegas a few weeks ago for the Senior International Table Tennis Championships.
Oh.
So all the ping pong players, senior tournament, the worldwide senior tournament was in Las Vegas. And so all of the 40 years old and up ping pong players were there. And I did a part of the routine for their opening ceremony.
So I have to ask this, because I was talking to my daughter, who lives in Boston, by the way, coincidentally.
Oh, yeah.
Last night I was telling her I was going to interview you. And she said, is he a good ping pong player? I said, I don't know, I'll ask. So here I am asking.
I'm an okay ping pong player. I'm not in that competition level at all, because I never actually practice. I'm busy practicing other things with ping pong balls. So
ping pong spitting and things.
Yeah, the dime trick is actually hard, and I do have to practice. So
what is the dime trick?
Oh, at the end of the target spitting, the guy with all the ping pong balls on his vest.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of that act, I toss a dime up into the air and hit it by spinning the ping pong ball at it.
Oh, it's one of the many things that you hit. There's a few things, yes, you toss in the air and hit with the ping pong ball.
Right. And the dime is by far the most difficult.
I would think so. It's the smallest.
Yeah. It's, well, yeah, and it's hard to see because it's only a dime and there's light shining in my eyes.
All right, well, we're going to move into fact or something John just made up. Does that sound like fun?
Sure, I'm ready.
Is it fact? Or is it something John just made up?
Ah. All right, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to give you a headline and you're going to tell me if it's true or something I made up. And if it is true, tell me a little bit more about it.
Okay.
Here we go. First headline, Michael balanced a child's seat in a chair on his chin.
For many years, there was me and one other guy who worked at Venice Beach who did a similar trick, balancing a person in a chair on their chin.
Oh.
I started doing that on the street in Boston in about 1982 or three. And I first did it with a lawn chair. And I'd get the kids, put him in the lawn chair, and then tie him in with the rope so that he couldn't come out, and then pick the whole thing up and balance it on my chin.
Hmm.
I eventually, that long of a setup didn't go anywhere. But I did that for years and years and learned how to do it with a simple plastic folding chair.
Oh.
Had the kid and it had to have the bar across the ground level at the bottom of the back legs.
There's a great, you have a great video on your YouTube channel of that particular stunt.
That's about the last time I did it.
It's very cute.
It was fun. I was, you know, it was what I closed my street show with for years and years. You know, it was the most spectacular thing I could do. It was fun. It was, I never dropped a child, although I thought about it.
If you could just teach that kid to juggle fire, everything.
You know, yeah, it's like you're lucky to have them sit still for long enough.
I tell you, when I was watching that video, I was nervous. I was nervous for you. I was nervous for the kid.
Good.
All right, let's go on to the next one. Michael was born with one arm 4 inches longer than the other.
That's not at all true. It's only about half an inch longer. But, it looks that way. And I know why you're saying that, because of the my arms gag.
Yep.
It's my version of, well, George Carl did it in his act a lot, his one arm being longer than the other. He used his suit coat doing that.
Yeah. It's a great video. One of my favorite parts of that video is when you're making your arms, you know, one arm is longer, then of course you make the other arm longer, then it's too long, and then you make the other arm longer and it's too long. And one of my favorite pieces of that video is when your hands, one hand is under your foot and the other hand is a little too far to reach your foot, and then you use this the smallest little gesture with your finger to make your other foot come up. It's just it's a great little piece of business.
Thank you. I love that. Thank you. I'm glad that you appreciate that. I don't know how old you are, John. When I was growing up, I can remember seeing Jim Henson on Johnny Carson doing a puppet act, and all he used was his hands.
Oh.
You just saw his bare hands, but he just used his hands and had this whole little relationship thing with the hands between the two, as if it was two different people's hands. Fantastic piece of business, but you had to be focused on it. So I love that part that you know, they get there and that's where everyone's looking, because that's where all the movement has gone, and it's down and it's stopped, and it gives you that chance for just the tiniest gesture that can be seen a long way away, which is a hard thing to do.
All right, let's go on to the next one. Ready? Michael invented the skill of target spitting with ping pong balls. He actually invented it.
It's until somebody wants to get in the fist fight over it, I'm going to claim that to be true. As soon as anybody wants to get physical, I'll step down or I'll spit a ping pong ball at them. Yes. You know what? It's interesting. I had a routine back when I was in the 70s, when I started doing the school tours. My first tour was I was doing a school, so 13 shows a week down in Georgia. And never in a town that was bigger than about 3,000 people. And so I was doing school shows down there and, you know, still making up the material. And I came up with a target spitting routine there. or a spitting routine. It wasn't a target spitting routine as much as it was just a spitting routine, because this was the 70s and everybody smoked, and plenty of people in the South chewed tobacco. And I started doing this act where I'd have a tin can, and I'd have put a big ping pong ball on my cheek, so it looked like I had a big wad of tobacco in there. And I'd not actually spit, but I'd pretend to spit and then catch that spit in the can. And every time it hit the can, it'd make a little noise. You know, you'd hear it go chink. And so I was doing trick shots with just tobacco spitting in the schools. How's that? What a great country.
That's when people were doing tricks with cigarettes and things.
Yes, absolutely. But that was the earliest I did that sort of an act, and target shooting and trick shots have been a thing forever. So, as far as I know, actually using my mouth to shoot ping pong balls and hit targets, nobody else has been doing as a target act.
Here we go. We're going to move on to the next headline. Michael's act was the inspiration for the novel The Disapparation of James.
That's absolutely true.
True.
Yes, it is. A woman named Anne Ursu, U-R-S-U, saw me when I was with the Big Apple Circus. We came to Portland, Maine, where my home is. We came, and she was a local writer for the Phoenix, I believe, and came and saw the show and reviewed it. And then later on, she sent me a note and said, "Michael, this is Anne Ursu. I know who you are. I saw your show. I've written a novel, and I want to base it on this trick that you did in the show, and so that you will be a character in the novel." And so she and I said, "Well, sure, all right. Well, let me, And so she did, and she wrote this novel, and it was quite a while. I think it came out in around 03 or 04, and I owned probably a significant share of the books that sold.
Nice,
because I've got two. I was doing the kid in the chair trick at the time in the circus, and her takeoff point was that she went to see this show, and the clown who bore a physical resemblance to me did the trick, and the kid's up in the chair, and all of a sudden there's a flash and the kid disappears.
Oh,
everybody who saw it at the circus thought it was a fantastic trick, and and they went on with the show, but the kid had actually disappeared. And so that was the jumping off point of this novel, which was sort of a fantasy idea.
How fun.
That was Fact. Or something John just made up.
Tell us about one of your performing horror stories there, Michael. Do you have one for us?
Oh, unfortunately, I have many, but I have one. I like to tell this one more of just me being a horror. At one point, I was booked to do a show for a family series that was not very far from my home here in Maine, out in the country. A beautiful little theater space. It had been a former church that had been converted. So I was getting ready for that, and it was coming up in a few days, and I had an incident with my back, and my back spasmed and went out, and I was just completely laid out with that, and so I could barely stand. I was taking muscle relaxers and all this stuff, but I didn't want to cancel the show at all. So I got a friend of mine, Leland Faulkner, who he's here in Maine. We've been actually friends since we started back in the 70s together out in Kansas City. So Lee said he would come and do the show with me, and I would do what I could. So we're there, and we're getting ready for the show, and the audience comes in, and I go out to start the show, and I welcome everybody, and it was explaining to them that I'm a little bit unsteady. I've had a back injury, and so I've been taking lots of muscle relaxers and painkillers, and there's many things I can't simply do in the show. So I've invited one of my oldest friends to be here in the show. Ladies and gentlemen, the magician Leland Faulkner is here today because of my bulging dick.
Because what? Because of what?
Disc.
Oh, and you said that?
Yes. And that, you know, that second and a half there between me saying that and you going, what? Was that dead space was much longer in the theater. Except for there was one young mother who I believe sort of yelped, and it was just dead silent. And it was just, I was as embarrassed as I could be to have, you know. And I knew why it was. It was because I'm all drugged up and feeling pretty good. And yeah, it was an embarrassment.
That's great. Or it's horrible. Yeah. I'm not sure which.
Yeah, see? There you go.
All right, now give us a piece of advice for the beginner.
A piece of advice for the beginner.
Yeah.
Never stop training. Never stop taking a class of mm-hmm. some sort. Anybody who wants to be a performer on stage, the best advice I can give you is to study every kind of movement that you can. It goes back to my idea that body language is the only universal language. And if we pay more attention to it, we become better at using our body language. And if you take a movement class of any kind, it helps you increase your movement vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. And then how about the working pro?
Same advice for the working pro. Get out there and take a class. Work with a director is my advice to the working pro. Find somebody that you feel like you can collaborate with and have get in the studio with them, because their support and vision and you know, just reflecting back at you will help you grow and become better.
Absolutely. Now, do you have a book or two to recommend for us?
I'll show you what I'm reading right now. I found a copy of The Moving Body. It was a book about Jacques Lecoq's teaching technique. I studied with him I just did the first year back in 87, 88. But it's a nice little paperback sized book that talks about his biography and then also his exercises and the stuff that you worked on. There's even a whole chapter called The Road to Creativity.
What's the name of that book?
The Moving Body.
The Moving Body. Okay. I'll put that on my website.
Yeah. And then the other book that I found that I am loving is a book of surrealist games.
Oh.
It's a little handbook, and it was created, I think, in about 1995. And it's a collection of surrealist games. So it's kind of hard to explain.
Yeah, I'm confused. What does that mean?
It starts off with, do you know what automatic writing is?
No.
Here, I'll read you just automatic writing is the most direct of surrealist techniques. Sit at a table with pen and paper, put yourself in a receptive frame of mind and start writing. Continue writing without thinking about what is appearing beneath your pen. Write as fast as you can. If for some reason the flow stops, leave a space and immediately begin again by writing down the first letter of the next sentence. Huh. Choose this letter at random before you begin, for instance, a T, and always begin this new sentence with a T. And so it's stream of consciousness improvisation that is completely uncontrolled. And there's that's sort of the start of the surrealist games and all the beat poets and that generation who were exploring language in new ways made use of it. And I picked this book up because I thought, you know what, there's got to be some great improvisational games to use in teaching.
Oh, yeah.
How do we invent? How do we create? And that's one of my premises about performing and teaching and creating. And it goes back to that first thing that I talked about, the rounds, you know, taking an idea and playing with it. My belief is that improvisation is just like a muscle. You have to exercise it all the time in order to make it work for you. And so you have to get in the studio and improvise by yourself. You have to get a group of friends in with you and improvise with each other. Because there's so many different ways and forms of improvisation, and you just need to keep that ability to play and to invent and create functioning, and it's going to function best if it's well oiled.
Yep. And what is the name of that book that you started talking about? Surrealist Games?
It's A Book of Surrealist Games.
A Book of Surrealist Games. I'll put that on my website also. Thank you, Michael, for doing my podcast. Where can they get a hold of you?
They can find me on the internet. I have a website, michaeltrautman.com. Trautman spelled T-R-A-U-T-M-A-N. I also have a YouTube page, Michael Trautman, and there's not that many of us, so you should be able to find me there on YouTube. I have an Instagram account. You can find all of that information on my website, michaeltrautman.com. Facebook pages, and there is actually a King Pong fan page.
Oh.
So you can search that out too.
I haven't even seen that yet. I'm going to hunt that down. Thanks to all my variety artists that are listening. If you found this podcast valuable, tell a friend. That's how we can spread the word. And don't forget to go to my website to get your free copywriting checklist at thevarietyartist.com. And feel free to reach me at my email at john@thevarietyartist.com, or join my Facebook group at The Variety Artists, where you can ask me to ask questions of our guests. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.